desk. "Sounds exciting," I say, not sounding in the least bit excited as my mind races forward, assessing the best way to get the answers I need from him. "That is, if you return from this suspension, of course. How are you coping? What's it been? 2 days now?" he asks, packing the visor into a titanium case. "Fine," I lie, not wanting to give him this satisfaction. "Really?" The foam lining squeaks as he slides the visor snugly inside. The sound makes me shudder. "That's disappointing. I was hoping it would be a lesson to you, son." Son. The way he emphasizes the word makes it seem forced, like he's not used to saying it. A lesson, I ask. "Yes. A lesson in discipline. A lesson in restraint. For too long you've walked the line and your name, my name, has kept you here when so many others would have lost a whole lot more than their jobs," he spits, not making eye contact with me. "That's the only reason I'm here, is it? Because of your name. Not because I'm the best performing pilot the EPO has ever employed, or the longest serving, most dedicated member of the squad. The one Eve trusts more than anyone else." I bite back, my heart beginning to race. "Eve trusts you, that's true. But you have abused that trust, like other foolish young men before you." Carefully and precisely, he closes the lid to the visor case and locks it with his thumbprint. "Well, I guess that's something we all have in common in this place," I snap. He doesn't say anything, but his face dares me to continue the thought. "We've all abused her trust. Everyone in this place, from the guards at level zero through to Vivian in the penthouse. Eve lives up there in the perfect world Vivian invented for her. A world that you helped create, completely oblivious to reality." "Guilty as charged," he says, holding up his hands, mocking surrender. "But tell me, son." He moves to the window and flicks his wrist. "Would this inspire you to save humanity?" The outside storm bursts to life on the screen. Rain pounds the side of the tower as a bolt of lightning illuminates the pollution clouds, bathing the room in a deep, eerie purple. "Would you want to save a race that has done everything but completely destroy the planet sustaining it?" he asks, and there's fire in his eyes that I've not seen since we first came here, when Vivian plucked him from the gutter and gave him purpose, gave him power. "If that would be her choice, then it's one we surely deserve. What gave us the right to decide for her?" I ask, slowly and calmly. "My God, boy, you're beginning to sound like one of them." He seems truly disgusted by my question as he points to the faint silhouette of the city's cloudscrapers in the distance. There is silence. The atmosphere is thick. I can sense his frustration with me building like the storm. The signals he's projecting are hateful. My father can't even look at me. "How is she?" I ask. "You're not permitted to know that while you're on suspension," he replies. "Oh, come on, Dad. Is she okay?" I ask again. He closes his eyes and sighs, letting his shoulders sink underneath his crisp, deep red shirt. "I think it's time you returned to your dorm and studied," he says bluntly. "Sending me to my room? I'm not a kid anymore." He pauses. I sense his irritation at my persistence, but I hold my ground. I'm not going anywhere. "What did you come here for?" he asks, obviously wanting to get rid of me. "I need some answers." The room is quiet and my father is still. I see lightning striking the city, reflected in the lenses of my father's glasses as he stares outside, magnified and warped. That's how he views the world. "Answers?" he asks. I nod. "Answers require questions," he says. "Corin Warren," I say slowly. That name is never spoken here. Not unless it's whispered behind closed doors. It feels strange forming her name with my lips. My father's eyebrow twitches. The wrinkles at the corners of his eyes deepen as he squints, obliterating the freckles and moles that surround them. "A name is not a question," he says. "No, but that name raises so many, I'm not sure where to begin," I reply. "I've heard so many stories about Eve's mother, so many theories, and if any of them were true..." "Yes," my father fills my silence. "Then surely you must know about it." I say it. Just like that. He moves nothing but his eyes. They lock with mine. He stares with an uncomfortable intensity that urges me to look away. I don't. What stories are you referring to? He asks. You know what I'm talking about. Don't play ignorant with me, Dad. He studies me as he would a chessboard, carefully plotting three moves ahead and never giving away his plan. I don't break the silence. It's his move. I'm assuming you're referring to the rumors around Corin's death. Rumors concocted by a mentally ill, emotionally unstable man. He sounds like he's reading some sort of press release. He's been media trained to perfection. I nod. Tell me, who speaks about these stories in here? He asks. I pause. He's trying to distract me with this question, pretending he wants to discover the source of my knowledge while he prepares his true attack. Everyone, I say simply, shrugging it off like it's no big deal. I see, and everyone assumes that because you are my son, you must know something. That you must be in on it, he says, almost smiling. Something like that, yeah. Why is he laughing? Am I losing the game he's playing, or is this a bluff? Funny, isn't it? How people assume the importance of a relationship. How much stature you are bestowed because I chose to bless you with my name. He places the tips of his fingers together, his index finger grazing his lips as they curl into a smile. The truth, Bram, is that you were spared due to simple necessity. My turn to use silence to dare him to continue. When your mother joined the millions to fail to produce a female, you were to be disposed of along with the countless other boys that this planet had no room to accommodate. His words cut more than I expect them to. More than I think even he realizes. Did my mother agree to that? I had no objections. It was nothing unusual, but your mother had other plans. He slips comfortably into his chair and crosses his legs casually. He's enjoying this. She hid you, kept you secret from me until you were past the age when anyone respectable would deal with you. My heart pounds at this new information about my existence. It aches at the thought of my mother fighting for me to live. Of course, I was totally wrong. Did he just say that? I thought you were just another male to join the endless list of missing boys, or whatever they call them these days. It was so obvious, but I failed to see your potential, until she came along. Eve, I say. No, he laughs. Miss Silver. He stands abruptly, becoming more animated as he reminisces. She pulled me from the depths of that hellhole and saw the potential in my work. She had the resources to allow my imagination to run wild. He stands and moves to the window. Of course, I never wanted to bring you here. If the window wasn't just a reality TV screen, I'd be tempted to push him through it. Vivian needed a young female companion for Eve, and my ideas were the answer. That was when the pilot technology was conceived, and I just so happened to have the perfect guinea pig for my innovations. Guinea pig, I repeat, the words catching in my throat. I think we both know that I'm not a model father, even by today's abysmal standards, he says. Is that an excuse or an apology? I ask. Neither. It is simply the truth. And what is simply the truth about Eve's mother and father? Were they model parents? Unfortunately, I assume they would have been, yes, he snaps. Unfortunately, was that a problem? Were parents never part of the plan for Eve? Corin and Ernie were too much of a risk. Their presence in her life made the future unpredictable. Vivian could not accept unpredictability. He stops himself. His cheeks are red and a vein in his forehead pulses with his breath. I'm silent. He's silent. My heart is pumping so hard I swear I can see the zip of my uniform jumping. I have to give myself a moment to absorb the information he just delivered, to figure out what this means. Vivian did do something to Corin. The words tumble out of my mouth. I'm speaking more to myself than to him. His eyes slide up carefully, like they're slicing me in two. The rumors are true. My father knows.
Chapter 33. Bram. His breathing remains short. His eyes are fixed on mine and his body is rooted to the spot, but inside his brain he is frantic. Passion made him weak. He has made a wrong move.
So it's true,
I whisper, at first with disbelief. Something more did happen. As I speak, I realize how obvious it is.
And you knew about it. You've always known.
I stand immediately and head for the door, but a firm grip restrains my wrist. I look down to see my father's pale hand grasping it.
Son, he growls.
I snatch my arm away and move around the beaten leather chair, putting it between us.
Let me explain. You're confused and your emotions are clouding your judgment, he says.
No, father. I'm thinking clearly. Perhaps for the first time in my life, I'm seeing things as they really are.
And how's that? What are you seeing? He asks.
I see that it's not just Eve you're keeping under this cloud of illusion. It's all of us. It's everyone in this place. We're all being fed lie upon lie, and the real kick in the teeth is that it's all to keep this lie alive, I say, spreading my arms wide in realization at the real purpose of this place. My head is sprinting.
It's a perfect system. Completely screwed up, but perfect.
My father has backed away. He's listening to me, watching me as my mind opens to the reality of the world I'm living in.
So where is he? I ask.
He?
Eve's father, where is he now?
Oh, he's somewhere safe. Somewhere he can't hurt Eve.
Stop lying! I scream. I know now, Dad, I know the truth!
I see, he says, leaning on his desk. But if you were right, if the rumors were true, if the EPO purposely eliminated Eve's parents from her future, how come you're the only one to work it out? How come there haven't been others?
Oh, there are others, I say, as I walk to his reality TV monitor. There are hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of others who worked it out long before me, who've been screaming it, marching against it, protesting it for years.
I point out to the flooded city, hidden by pollution. I never thought I'd say this, but the damn Freevers were right.
Then why hasn't anyone in here done anything about it? Why haven't we been stopped?
He asks, and I notice that small, malicious smile twitch back onto his face. My heart starts pounding.
People have worked it out. They've been figuring it out for years, but whenever someone gets too close to the truth, they...
Suddenly, red emergency lighting engulfs the room and the piercing screech of a siren vibrates inside my skull. I see shattered glass on the floor by my father's feet. Glass from the emergency alarm. My dad has pulled the security alarm on me. In the pulsing red light, I catch a flash in the reflection of my father's glasses as his head whips up from the top drawer of his vintage desk. Something glistens in the light. It's heavy in his hands as he raises the long barrel in my direction. I dive behind the chair as he pulls the trigger of the antique weapon. The explosion blasts a hole twice as big as my head in the leather. My body slides across the polished hardwood floor and I'm stopped only by the wall.
I should have done this the second you were born.
He pulls the trigger again. The wood at my feet splinters into a thousand shards. His inexperienced aim and the age of the gun are the only reasons I'm not plastered all over the wall.
Dr. Wells?
Wu calls from the other side of the door. I take advantage of the distraction and bolt towards it. My father doesn't hesitate. He wants me dead. I'm too dangerous now. I know too much. He shoots. The glass shatters, revealing Wu's cowering figure. I leap through the now empty frame and don't look back. Wu freezes on the spot, paralyzed with her programmed fear in the center of the hallway. I hurtle through her as though she's nothing but air, disturbing the light flow as I sprint down the corridor as fast as my boots will carry me. I don't stop to see where the next shot lands, but the shower of wood splinters and chippings suggests that it was the wall to my right. My feet feel the smooth poured concrete under them as I land after hurdling the steel desk, the lights making everything red, then pitch black. Red. Black. Red. Black. Ketch. His squad exit the lift, armed and ready.
Arrest him,
my father calls as he rounds the corner, his gun nowhere to be seen. He is a traitor and a liar and not to be trusted. He is now to be considered a threat to Eve's safety. You have my orders to arrest him using any methods necessary. I look Ketch in the eye. I can see his confusion. Bram, he says, let's calm this down, shall we? I may know these guys, but my father owns them. From now on, they cannot be trusted. I can't assume they'll go easy on me. Their eyes have not been opened yet. They are still part of the lie. This is what they are trained for. You don't have to do this, Ketch, I say, keeping my eye on all five members of his security force as they reposition themselves to get advantage over me. Don't trust him, guys. We've all been lied to. He has been brainwashed. Do not listen to a word he is saying. Arrest him at once, my father demands, standing behind the steel desk. You know the drill now, Bram, Krutz, second in command, says as he approaches me. Take my hand and we won't have a problem. He reaches out to me, spreading his gloved fingers wide. His fingertips glow blue and emit a soft, steam-like haze. A pacify glove, designed to induce a peaceful, unconscious state to whoever takes the hand of the wearer. The action of taking someone's hand symbolizes compliance, surrender, when all options have been exhausted and there's nowhere left to run. Bram? He steps a little closer, spreading his fingers wider. Tiny blue dots appear on my chest in my peripheral vision. I sense more than see them. The alternative way to use the pacify glove. 500,000 volts pulse through the subject's chest and into their heart. Not quite as peaceful as the first option, but far more common. Don't make me do this, Bram. I like you, man, he says as the squad edge a little closer. They create a semicircle in front of me, blocking my path to the lift. The route to my father's office sits to my right, a dead end, literally. Behind me, a solid wall, unimaginably thick, acts like the sixth member of Ketch's team, boxing me in. I scan my surroundings, searching every surface, every object. I feel adrenaline rip through my veins as my body switches to fight or flight mode. Fighting is not an option. Flight? My back hits the wall as I take the last step away from them. My heart stops. As they continue approaching, I slide my hand discreetly behind my back and feel along the cold panel. It's smooth. Nothing there as I run my hand along. But then, it's here. I feel it. An emergency exit chute. I don't have to see it to know exactly what my fingers are touching. A small glass box with a red handle inside. Above it there is writing. Pull to activate chute. Emergency use only. They line the walls of every floor at regular intervals, my father's office being no exception. Thank God for health and safety regulations. The blue beams of laser light on my chest burn hotter as the team loom closer. I don't waste another second. I pound the glass with my fist, open my mouth, and pull the handle as hard as I can. I feel the air freeze instantly as the seal to the chute entrance cracks open. The difference in air pressure blows the wall panel out and sucks it down the chute. The squad drop to their knees, grabbing at their ears with their hands, their eardrums having burst the second I open the hole in the side of the building. Opening your mouth allows the pressure to disperse. Simple, but effective. Their pain buys me a few seconds. I use them to glance at my father, who is scrambling back to his feet behind the desk, fear, anger, and pain on his face. Our eyes meet. And in that moment he knows I'll come back. I'll come back for Eve. I lean backwards and let the air take me through the chute, over the edge of the building and down towards the world below. The world outside the tower. The real world.
Chapter 34. Eve. When I regain consciousness, the mothers are looking around the room frantically. At first I think it's because I passed out, but the speed at which Mother Tabia yanks at my arm and gets me to my feet tells me it's something else. Slowly, I become aware of sirens blasting from the speakers in the hallway, calling us all into action as they alert us to some unknown danger. "What's going on?" I whisper, feeling frail, weak, and fearful. "We need to get you to safety," says Mother Cardi, widening her eyes at Mother Tabia, as though confirming a plan. Then she gestures for us to follow her. Mother's Tabia and Kimberly's arms loop mine protectively, taking most of my weight as we exit the room. We run down the corridor and through the garden zones. Several other mothers join us, each one looking as perplexed as I feel. They gather around us, with me in the center of the group, their eyes darting around the space as though they're seeking out any hazards. The way they sidestep obstacles and squeeze through gaps belies the fact that they're all well into their 60s and beyond. Right now, they're able and determined. I try to question those around me so that I can understand what's happened, where we're going, or what we're running from, but there's no answer. They don't even look at me. Everyone is focused on getting where we need to be. To my surprise, they lead me towards my bedroom. Once we've all clambered up my spiral staircase, the glass door is shut behind us. We hear the lock slam into place as the thick panel frosts over, separating us from the rest of the dome. The women around me, all of whom are out of breath, sigh with relief. I've never seen any of them move so fast. "What's going on?" I repeat, with more determination than before. Mother Kimberly turns to me with troubled eyes. "I've no idea," she whispers, apprehension in her voice. I catch Mother Cardi's eye. Perhaps she can offer some clarity. But she looks at Mother Tabia. "No sitting down. Come on," Mother Tabia calls to Mother Caroline, who's perched on the side of my sofa. I feel for her as she hurls herself back to her feet. At 96, she is the oldest mother here. That doesn't usually hold her back, but she's not normally sprinting through the building. I turn to see Mother Tabia muttering nervously to herself, while her trembling hands reach out and swipe a handful of books from the shelf onto the floor. She places her wrinkled hand on the white wall, which suddenly glows. The edges of the shelf unit hiss as the whole thing swings forward, and I realize that it is a door, not simply a place to store my few possessions. What? How? When? I'm asking the backs of the women's heads as everybody makes their way towards the newly exposed doorway and along a narrow corridor lined with steel. We walk for 100 meters or so before Mother Tabia pushes open another door and we enter a room. The brightly lit space is filled with a few dilapidated sofas, several bunk beds, a shelving unit containing books and ancient board games, a little kitchen area, and a bathroom. As far as I can tell, there are no windows or exits apart from the one we've walked through. There is a black telephone and a shimmering screen on the wall, showing nothing but three letters, E-P-O, rotating continuously. A safe room? The surprise in my voice doesn't come from there being one. I've been in many over the years, usually with Holly to keep me company. These little areas are dotted all around the dome, but I've never been aware of one branching off the room I've slept in for more than a decade and thought I knew like the back of my hand. Understandably, I feel a little duped and cheated. I haven't been lied to, but they've kept it a secret from me until now. The phone rings, causing the mothers to fall silent, knowing this call will offer us some answers. "Mother Tabia speaking," she says, picking up the receiver in a voice that seems perkier and more pleasing than her own. I watch as she listens intently to the person at the other end of the line while her fingers grip the cable. She sighs. She frowns. She bites her lip and nods. Her eyes glance up at mine, then down to the floor. "Of course. We'll stay here until we know more. Thank you." As soon as she's hung up, the rest of the mothers ask all the questions I'm wondering. "What has happened? Are we in danger? Where are we? How long will we be in here for? Who's on the phone?" "Calm down, calm down," Mother Tabia says, waving her hands to shush us. "It was Ketch. There's been a situation downstairs." "What sort of situation?" asks Mother Kimberly. "I'm not sure." "Well, what did he say?" demands Mother Caroline, impatiently, her hands rubbing her hips. Mother Tabia glances at me and they fall silent. Ah, they have decided this matter is not for my ears. "What's happened?" I ask, aware that my voice is louder than I mean it to be. "Everything is fine. This is only a precaution," Mother Tabia says calmly. "A precaution from what?" "I'm not sure." "Then what was said on the phone?" I'm letting her know that I'm not going to leave the matter until I'm told more. "Someone has threatened our security," she reveals, pressing the palms of her hands together as though in prayer. All the mothers start talking at once, asking more questions or muttering their concerns to themselves. "Now, now," Mother Tabia calls over them. "We're safe here, so let's not panic until we know more. For now, let's just sit tight. We won't be in here long, I'm sure." "I'll pot the kettle on," Mother Kimberly says decisively, scuttling off into the kitchen area, while the other mothers congregate in groups to continue speculating. Some just standing in the middle of the room, others getting comfortable on the red sofas lining the walls. As awful as it is, I take some comfort from the fact that I'm not the only one being kept in the dark. "You should have a lie down," says Mother Cardi, her hand gripping my elbow as she leads me towards a lower bunk bed. "I don't want to," I moan. "Well, you will," she says, handing me my Rubik's Cube, which she must have picked up from my room. I place it on the bed next to me. I'm glad she brought it, but I'm not about to tell her that. "And you're going to eat something too." The firmness in her voice stops me answering back. I crouch onto the bunk, as asked, and almost feel relieved as my tired body melts into the mattress. I am beaten, both mentally and physically. I'm exhausted. Satisfied that I've listened to her, Mother Cardi pats my shoulder before turning away. I watch her exchange a few words with each of them, eventually reaching the mini kitchen area where she rummages through the cupboards and starts pulling out tins, each one hitting the countertop with a loud clank that makes my head throb. I rub my temples, wondering how my life could have flipped so dramatically in the last 48 hours. While Mother Cardi dollops food onto a plate, Mother Tabia approaches and stands beside her. As they have their backs to me, I can't make out what's being said, but their hushed tones make it all the more intriguing. The conversation goes back and forth, Mother Cardi nodding in agreement. Apparently satisfied, Mother Tabia busies herself with sorting through the books, while Mother Cardi snatches up some cutlery and the plate, then heads over to me. I shuffle backwards, making space so that she can perch on the side of my bed. She puts the plate beside me and offers me the knife and fork. Even though I'm not hungry, I sit up and put a spoonful of cold baked beans into my mouth and chew. My tummy growls. I shovel in spoonful after spoonful until I clear the plate. I instantly feel heavy and sick. "Thank you," Mother Cardi whispers, her hand resting on my wrist before she picks up the Rubik's Cube by my pillow and plays with it, treating it like a ball. As I look at her, I remember Vivian's threat to evict her and the others. But if the outside world is as pleasant as they've made me think it is, then what would be the issue? To live out there, to have that little stream to sit beside, would be a blessing. That's why I'm here, surely. To ensure future generations get to enjoy that beauty. Vivian spoke of the world outside in much the same way that she told me of the guards all those years ago. That I had to hide myself and avoid eye contact with them so that I didn't get spoiled. And Mother Nina admitted that women stopped going to bars. I don't think she would have lied to me about such a thing. In a time of no hope, I can almost understand things changing to protect the last generations of women. But that was before I was born. Before I gave them the opportunity to ensure that our race survived. If the public really are looking to me for hope, surely they wouldn't hurt me. And if that's so, why do I need Vivian to dictate things? Surely there's a way for all this to happen naturally. I'm sure that, just as Vivian said, the world outside contains cruel and barbaric people, but others may be full of compassion. Living up here in confinement means I have no way of knowing. "Feeling better?" Mother Cardi asks. I nod and smile. "What's happened?" I ask, keeping my voice low in the hope that she'll confide in me. "Eve," she sighs, putting my toy back beside me as she realizes that the main reason I've complied with her requests is to gain information. "I want to know why we're in here." "There was an incident," she mutters, glancing at the other mothers who are talking amongst themselves. "Keep going," I whisper, picking up my Rubik's Cube as though we aren't even talking to each other. "Your friend?" "Bram. Did anything happen?" "Your friend has left," she says. I run the words over in my head and try to make sense of them, wondering if they've kicked him out or whether he's fled, because surely he would have stayed if that were an option. "Gone where?" I ask slowly, still twisting the toy in my hands as my brain churns through the possibilities and panics at the thought of life without him. Is he okay? I don't know. What happened? I sit up so that I can hear her more clearly. I've not been told exactly, but there was a concern that you might have been the target of an attack. He'd never hurt me, I say, feeling the blood drain from my face at the thought of someone I care about so much possibly being capable of such a thing. Eve, not all people are good, she says. I know that. I frown, annoyed that she considers me so gullible and naive. I encounter the wrath of Vivian on a daily basis and witness the murder of the kindest woman I've ever known. Of course there are bad souls, but I'm certain Bram is not one of them. Do you? She says, her voice calm and kind as she pulls her fingers through my ponytail. Sometimes I wonder if they've done you a disservice by allowing you to remain so sheltered here. I'm not sheltered, my jaw tenses. She opens her mouth to say more, but stops herself. I know there are bad people in the world, I tell her adamantly. He's not one of them. He's nothing like Diego. Maybe not. But there are also people who think they're good, but can't distinguish whether their actions work for good or evil. Their views are wonky, their trust misplaced. How do you know yours aren't? She gives me a stern look as she takes a long, slow breath. I made a pledge to protect you, as has every woman in this room, she says. We love you as though you were one of our own children. Did you have any other children? I ask. I miscarried several times, all girls, but birthed 8 boys, she says, her tone unwavering. And where are they now? The wooden beads around her neck bash together as she shrugs. I made a choice when I came here. You. You were my choice. But your boys? Her expression is unabashed. So they made you disown your own flesh and blood. It's not that simple or heartless. We want a future for our children. She sniffs, looking around the room before bowing her head into her chest. We believe in you, Eve. So we have given you our all. At such a cost? I ask, hearing the pain in my own voice. I've always been drawn to Mother Cardi. There's something about her that's enchantingly unique. She seems full of wisdom and a certain worldliness. Perhaps it's the colourful beads or the age-blurred tattoos that tell of a cultured life before she came here. She's petite, but she's fearlessly strong in spirit. I don't understand how such a woman could walk away from her family for someone she didn't know. It doesn't make sense to me. That's not for you to worry about, she says, getting up and ending the conversation. Before she leaves me, she turns and places her mouth against my ear. For what it's worth. I don't think he'd hurt you either, but they don't want him near you. I watch as she straightens up and takes my plate to the sink, then accepts a cup of tea from Mother Kimberly. Closing my eyes, I pretend to sleep, but all I can focus on is a tightening sensation in my chest and an overwhelming feeling of loss. He's really left me.
Chapter 35. Bram. I'm falling head first, upside down along a slim carbon fiber tube. Emergency strip lighting flashes past, blinding me. I try to glance back up the chute. Has anyone followed me? It's impossible to move my head due to the G-force holding me against the wall as the chute rounds out, following the contours of the exterior of the mountain-shaped tower. My body slows from terminal velocity to a slightly more comfortable speed. I can move again. Just. The forces from the fall are diminishing as I approach flood level. I need to move fast. I need to think fast. Ketch's team will be making their way to wherever this chute ends. I won't have long. I lift my head and peer along the miles of tube I'm leaving behind. I never thought I'd be using one of these things. I'd rather this than a gauntlet, though. Something hits me. A freezing cold force slams into the top of my head, shooting down my neck and back like lightning. I want to scream with pain, but my breath is taken away from me as the icy temperature engulfs my entire body. The
The next panel of emergency lighting flashes by in a burst of yellow, and I see that the chute is half full of water. This is not normal. This is not good. My whole body burns as I submerge in the liquid, my descent slowing rapidly. There's no going back. This chute is a one-way trip with only one exit. Like the gauntlet, not all chutes on the tower were operational after today's drill. Some were declared unsafe and scheduled for maintenance. I guess this is why. The water is up to my chest as I continue sliding downwards. My ears submerge and I feel my body slowing even more. My heart pounds. How far is the exit? How long can I hold my breath? Is this tube big enough to swim in? I'm about to find out all those answers. It happens fast. The chute drops again, winding around the tower, and I'm totally submerged, completely upside down. My body slows as I sink into the water. I pull my arms up and try to swim, but my elbows hit the walls of the tube. I can just about kick my legs to give me some forward motion. It'll have to be enough. It's all I've got. I open my eyes and the pain is intense, excruciating. It feels like the fluid inside them wants to freeze. I kick. I know my body is using oxygen fast, but I'm not going to die without a fight. I use my fingers to grip the walls, assisting my restricted legs by pulling myself downwards along the tube, clawing chunks of ice out of my way. I can hear my heartbeat. It practically echoes around my head like a drummer inside my skull. It gets faster, faster, booming down the tube ahead of me. I must go down. It's against every instinct. When you're submerged in water, you want to go up, but if I turn back, I'll never get out. They'll leave me to rot in here. I must keep moving. There are only two options for me now. Either I make it out, or I die trying. Suddenly I see it. The chute straightens in front of me, leveling off from vertical to horizontal in a tight bend, at the end of which is another panel of yellow lights, this one circled by green. Green is good. Green is my exit. My heart pounds at the sight, and adrenaline pumps through my veins. I accidentally release some air. Bubbles float away like tiny life rafts escaping. I can make it. I must make it. I kick my water-filled boots as hard as I can, smashing the side of the tube with each blow. The sound booms along the chute ahead of me, almost showing me my path to safety, like sonar. I grab at the walls and try to slide myself along faster, but my fingers slip on the ice that has formed on them. I feel my pulse throbbing in my neck as my body aches for oxygen. As I stare at the beautiful green exit lights illuminating the murky ice water, the edges of my vision begin to darken and blur. I claw at the walls, digging my fingernails into the frozen lining inside the chute. Suddenly, everything is glistening, sparkling, as though the water is full of diamonds or the sort of microscopic life that inhabits deep oceans and emits its own light. It's beautiful, losing consciousness. Peaceful. A block of ice smashes into my head. It burns, but it knocks a moment of sense into me. I can see the shape of the exit hatch a few feet out of reach, but my legs aren't cooperating. My body is shutting down, trying to protect itself from the cold. My fingers are useless too. I'm drifting, like a dead satellite, lost in space. The green is overpowering. The hatch is close, so very close. I blink and feel ice crystals crack and float away from my eyeballs. There is a small red square of lights in the center of the circular door in front of me, illuminating a metallic lever. I try to stretch out my arms. They obey, but in slow motion. The lights dim. The color fades. Now it's just white light on a gray door. My fingers graze the metal. It sends tingles up my arm. I wiggle my fingers but can't get a grip. It's just a few millimeters out of reach. The remaining air in my lungs is burning my throat, desperate for me to release it and replace it with clean, fresh oxygen. This is the end. My dying moments. My mind is racing now, thoughts traveling at light speed, flashing images into the forefront of whatever remains of my consciousness. My father. My mother. Hartman. Eve. The dome. A Rubik's Cube. Eve. Dangling my feet off the drop. Eve. 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 Whatever energy reserves my body was holding release into every muscle. Warmth swells inside me. My vision goes black, but then her face appears as I stretch for the last time. My fingers grip the handle, and as the air explodes from my mouth in a rush of bubbles, I pull hard and lose consciousness. Chapter 36. Bram. My lungs burn. I've never been able to feel them before, and now I wish I couldn't. I float across a small courtyard, flowing with the ice water that escaped with me from the chute. I have no energy to fight the current. It's dark, black even, or maybe my vision hasn't returned. I'm pretty sure I blacked out. Last thing I remember, I was underwater, reaching for a handle. I come to a halt lying face up, floating in a foot of water. With every breath of fresh oxygen come equal parts relief and agony. My vision is still blurry and colourless, but I can make out the enormity of the EPO tower standing over me. I've not seen it from this angle since I was a boy. When you make it inside the tower, you don't leave unless you have to. Unless they make you. I blink and take some deep, burning breaths, putting the pain to one side and enjoying the oxygen soaring around my body. As the color in my vision begins to return, so does my hearing. The silence is replaced by a high-pitched, constant ringing. It hurts. But before I can shake it off, it's replaced by something else. Something deeper, with rhythm. Something repetitive. Voices. Chanting voices. I gather my strength. There's no time to recover completely. I settle my breathing as best as I can, but I must get to my feet. I must work out where the hell I am and get as far away from here as possible. Ketch will be on his way down right now, and I've no doubt surveillance drones will drop through the cloud base at any second to locate me. I hurl myself onto my side and force myself to my knees as something hooks under my armpits and hoists me into the air like a doll. "It's one of them," a gruff voice booms. As he yanks hard on my soaked uniform, I see the outline of a surging crowd. I get my first distorted look at who he's speaking to, who the chanting voices belong to. Freevers. The raging crowd of protesters seems to multiply and the men in my immediate range hoist me above their heads, cheering, shouting, passing me around, parading me. I swing a punch and hit air. I swing again and get laughs in return. Fists pound my ribs from below. One connects with my stomach, knocking the wind out of me. "EPO scum! Criminal! Free Eve! Free Eve! Kill him! Free Eve!" The men's voices chant all around me. I'm completely at their mercy. All at once, the hands that are lifting me into the air are gripping me, pulling at my clothes, tugging me in different directions. Hands are everywhere, stretching my limbs, ripping at my skin. I've been fed to the lions. No, I fed myself to them. Suddenly the hands around my wet boots slip, and I see the filthy man stumble to the ground. Mid-50s, judging by the wrinkles on his skin. Wrinkles? My vision's returned. I swing my free leg around, driving the steel toe cap of my boot hard into the jaw of the muscular freever pulling at my other leg. Teeth fly through the air, and in the sudden commotion caused by my attack, I know I have a window of opportunity. This is my only chance. I must fight. My legs are free and I don't hesitate to use them. I wrap them around a young freever's head. He's around my age, but twice my size. As the crowd tries to pull me away, I use their momentum to bring him forward, driving him face first into the water. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. The crowd surrounding me loses its collective balance and falls back, releasing its grip on me. My body hits the water, but I'm back on my feet in a split second, fists ready for whoever gets up first. The surrounding men stand slowly, and I see their faces up close for the first time. This isn't like watching them on reality TV monitors, zooming in from my dorm as they protest outside. This is real. I can smell their matted beards, their sweat-soaked clothes. I can see the passion in their bloodshot eyes,
their hate for me and everything I represent. No, everything I used to represent. As I stare back at the 10 or so men who front the 100-strong crowd, I see the tower behind them. Its sleek metal frame, its impenetrable concrete walls. It is ugly, inside and out. Impressive, but ugly. Here in front of me, for the first time, I'm seeing something real. Men who stand for something they believe in, something I'm only just starting to understand. The truth. Wait! I say, holding up my hands. I'm not what you think I am. I'm not one of them. I point to the tower looming over us all. Suddenly I see the damage on my chute. Water is pouring out of holes from an explosion. I'm lucky I made it.
Your uniform says you are. A gritty voice grumbles back at me.
I look down at my jumpsuit. My name badge and the mission patches sewn onto my chest and arms give me away. I know what this looks like. But it's not what you think. I'm not one of them anymore. I try to sound genuine, which is always harder when you're actually being honest.
Don't listen to that shit, Stain. He's like every one of those bastards keeping her locked up in there, the heavy younger Freeva says.
Wait, look,
one of the older says through his grey, soggy beard. His deep brown, heavily scarred face glares menacingly across the flooded courtyard at my uniform.
Look at his patch. He's a pilot.
Whispers and gasps ripple back into the crowd, and they fall silent around me. I stay quiet. My heart races.
Is it true?
The gritty voice asks, his hard black eyes piercing into my own.
You've met Eve.
Do I tell them? Would they even believe me? Can I trust them? I nod. And as my mouth opens, something falls from the sky above, dropping through the purple clouds, buzzing like wasps from hell. Drones.
Run! The man orders. Retreat!
It's like someone has dropped a bomb of chaos on the protesters. A human stampede erupts in my direction as the sleek black craft scans the hundreds of faces, dropping fear gas canisters on particular areas once they've established I'm not there. I get body slammed to the ground. My head slips below the surface of the water, where the booted feet of Freevers stomp any serenity to death. Suddenly I'm pulled up. I can breathe again.
If you're a pilot, you're coming with us.
The scarred man's breath stinks as he spits his words at me, an inch from my face. I look into his eyes. Get me as far away from here as you can, and I swear I'll help you get what you want. He looks back up to the tower with a smirk.
You know how many of you insiders have said that. How many times we've paid for knowledge, put our trust in men of your kind and got nowhere.
You've never had anyone like me before. I grab his arm. I promise you that. He takes my words. Then he nods. Drops of water falling from his matted grey hair. A few wild dreadlocks whipping around as he stands to command his team.
Let's go, he orders.
His men reach down into the water, pull out homemade riot shields and lift them over their heads. As we hunch together beneath them and march out through a hole blown into the perimeter fence, I steal a final look up through a gap in our protection at the tower. And although I can't see the dome through the clouds, I stare in its direction and make her a promise. I'm coming back for you. Chapter 37. Bram. The wind pushes my cheeks back as we speed through what were once the streets of this enormous city in what I heard one of the Freevers call a pod. It's a homemade boat, its curved glass bottom allowing us to sail silently and speedily away. The makeshift engine strapped to the back is pretty impressive for the tech they've botched together out of whatever they could find or steal.
When we get closer, blindfold the pilot.
I hear the scarred man bark. I assume he's their leader. The younger, larger one nods and picks up a length of black material.
Two more of them coming in,
cries a Freeva from a pod sailing to our left as it weaves between the rooftops of two sunken buildings. The seven men in my pod look in the direction he's pointing, as do I, and see the two remaining drones following us. I'd watch them take down five in our escape through the perimeter wall, so these two shouldn't be a problem.
Down 'em, the leader orders.
The pod beside us immediately slows and falls back. It pulls up next to a flat rooftop that sits a meter above flood level. Two men climb up, silhouetted in the light emitted by the enormous tower in the distance. Although we're a few miles clear of the perimeter, the tower doesn't seem any smaller. In fact, against these sunken relics of Central's ancient landmarks, it seems even more colossal. Two rockets blast into the sky, illuminating the floodwater as they explode, like violent fireworks. Instead of pretty little sparks twinkling like starlight, sharp lightning bolts zap in every direction, electrifying anything they connect with. Clouds, buildings, water, drones. Both drones fizz and fry in the bolts, then drop out of the sky, making huge waves that rock our pod as they hit the water.
Salvage, the scarred man calls.
The two men drop back into their pod, head to the crash site, and begin pulling the smoking drones out of the water. So that's how they get their tech. Smart. The scarred man nods, and our pod picks up speed, throwing cold, salty water into my face. I swallow a mouthful and cough it back out. The men laugh, but I don't mind. It's refreshing to feel something real. If my life weren't in some serious danger right now, I might even be enjoying myself. The buildings get taller as we head into the heart of Central, once called London, following the sunken streets below us where the roots of these buildings now lie untouched at the bottom of this ever-growing ocean. Light from our pod streaks down into the watery ghost world below. My heart leaps as I see a face staring up from near street level, but it's nothing more than a statue reaching up at us, as if begging to be rescued. We turn a corner, floating above a wider, sunken street, and I see more statues observing us from the depths, as if our presence is interrupting their peaceful sleep. I've seen photos of these statues, of when they stood gracefully in this glorious city, before the storms claimed it. Just like every other city, or so we're told. I remind myself that I used to live out here, and as I take in the sights the city once had to offer, I can't believe people still do. Enjoying the view, are ya? The fat one says, kneeing me in the back. Just reminiscing, that's all, I say. I lived here once.
Really?
He whips the black material around my head and yanks me backwards, slamming me onto the glass floor of the pod.
Welcome home.
I hear him spit and feel it land on my face. I crawl back to the side of the pod, irritated that I can't see anything through the blindfold. Our boat makes multiple turns for the next 10 minutes. I try to trace its movement in my mind. I've looked down on these streets from the tower for most of my life, and can recall them like reading a map. If my senses are correct, I think we're about to enter the area where the gaps between the rooftops widen, where the spires and towers of wrecked buildings don't meet, where the old river used to wind through them like a snake. Wind rushes over my face, and I sense more space around us. I'm right. We're sailing down the old Thames route. There's a click, and even though I thought I couldn't see, everything somehow gets darker. The lights of the pod have been switched off. We're sailing in darkness now.
Dock them both and we'll take the dinghy across, the scarred man orders.
No one replies, but I sense their compliance as our pod turns to the right and crosses the river. We slow, and through the gauze of my blindfold, I see torchlight shining from somewhere outside our boat.
How many souls?
A young voice calls from alongside us.
All accounted for, plus one, someone beside me replies.
Who the hell is he?
Pilot.
There's a silence, and I sense people staring at me.
Say that again. I thought you said you'd picked up a pilot.
Someone grabs my arm and makes me stand. I feel his torch beam blast onto my chest, lighting up my mission patches.
Not here, you idiots, the leader barks. Get him to Ben, then you kids can gossip all you want.
Yes, Frost, sir,
the young voice stutters. Our pod hits something metallic and I lurch forward as the entire boat is hoisted out of the water. We come to a complete stop. No motion at all. In the slight pause in our journey, my head fills with questions.
Where are we going? Have we arrived? Can I escape? Who is Ben?
Suddenly, I'm lifted from the curved glass deck, and my stomach hits my throat as I fall. The water pierces my skin as I sink into it, the cold gripping my bones like the icy hands of the Grim Reaper pulling me down. They've thrown me overboard. I splash with my arms and feel the cold grip me tighter. Suddenly, they pull me up and out of the water. I flop into a dinghy, still blindfolded. Voices laugh and argue around me as I cough up salt water into the boat.
Jesus, if you're going to spew, do it over the side.
A new voice with a hint of the north says, as a nudge with his foot shows me where the side of the rubber boat is. I haul myself up onto it and feel the vessel speed off. I take the opportunity to adjust my blindfold minutely, giving me the thinnest sliver of a view down the crack between my cheek and the material. As we cross to the other side of the river, I see the glass pod we travelled in resting in its dock, suspended in a giant circular metal frame, half of which is submerged beneath the water. Freeva's making good use of Central's history. Resourceful bunch? As the small boat bounces across the open stretch of water, I tilt my head to see where we're headed, and realize I know where we're going. I know exactly who Ben is.
Chapter 38. Eve. Hours pass, with us women cooped up in the safe room, wondering what's going on outside as we potter around aimlessly. There's no way out. They've locked us in. Drinks are poured, more food is eaten, card games are played and naps taken, all while we wait for the phone to ring so that we can know more of the incident that has disrupted our daily routine and removed Bram. I lie on the bed, monotonously playing with my Rubik's Cube while my head becomes a little less giddy, thanks to the food I've been eating. I wonder what Bram could possibly have done to spark such a panic. The realization that they haven't sent a Holly to me keeps playing on my mind. I shouldn't be surprised, given that it was one of the Holly team who caused the lockdown, but the significance of me being put into a room that I didn't even know about is telling. If I didn't know about it, I can only assume the Hollies didn't either. And that must be what they want, to put me somewhere he can't find me. The thought sends a chill up my spine and makes me shudder. I don't want to think of us no longer being allowed that connection, or of him not being here. He's been the sparkle in my day for as long as I can remember. I wonder what could possibly have happened. It's been 2 days since we had our moment on the drop, and I don't believe it's taken this long for him to be reprimanded. He cared too much to leave me. I know he did. I don't believe he would have just left without saying anything, without giving me an inkling that he was thinking about it. But I've been pushing him more and more with each visit to show me himself. Maybe they deemed him too much of a risk, or maybe he found out something and threatened to tell me. Perhaps they wanted him to do something he was uncomfortable with, and Vivian sacrificed him as an example of what happens if you don't obey orders. Or maybe he'd had enough of life up here and just felt like getting out. Even I don't believe that. But the possibilities are endless, and unless someone is willing to give me answers, I guess I'll never know the truth. This is how my time has been spent. I've been worrying about Bram and dreaming of all the things I don't know about life in the tower and the world outside, and how I can find out what's being kept from me. A trio of musical notes sounds loudly, causing the women around me to hush their conversations and focus on the screen as it flickers from its usual logo to Vivian's face. I move to the other side of the bed to get a better view. She looks as stern, cold, and unperturbed as usual, her eyes squinting through the screen as though she can see each and every one of us. Maybe she can. I've no doubt they've got cameras on us here, too. She sits there, as still as stone, waiting to ensure she has our full attention. It looks as though she's linking in from her office, although I doubt she'd have remained in there with all of us herded into this little bunker. I imagine the thought of being here with us was too much. I've no doubt her office is just as protected as this room, and more practical. She can still control everyone from there. And we all know how much she loves control. She's an important woman, after all. I'm sure anyone of such stature has enemies regardless of their behavior, But as she's heartless, I'm sure she's more hated than anyone else. But maybe I'm wrong. It was the people who put her in that position of power. I think back to the Vivian I used to know, and the woman my